Welcome. From sex in the previous lecture to death in this one, a natural, even inevitable progression. Before I get dug in, however, no pun intended, I should declare a vested interest in this subject. Funerary ritual in the Greek world was the topic of my PhD thesis at University College London. One of my friends mockingly christened me Burial Bob. It was a badge I wore with pride. The study of death particularly fascinates me because it brings us face to face with the ancients. When Vesuvius erupted on August the 24th AD, 79, it buried Pompeii in mud and other detritus, Herculaneum in liquid tufa. The wall paintings at Herculaneum and Pompeii have survived because the eruption of Vesuvius afforded them a protective covering of ash. In one painting at Pompeii, you can actually see that the painter's hand has left a smear of paint on the half-finished fresco, moments before he died under an avalanche of ash. How much closer can we get to history than that? The whole world is the graveyard of famous men. Andron ga epiphanon pasage taphos. The line comes from the funeral speech which the statesman Pericles delivered over the Athenian soldiers who had died in the first year of the Peloponnesian War. Or at least, it comes from the version of the speech that is recorded by Thucydides. It was customary practice for the Athenians to bury all the war dead in a single ceremony at the end of the campaigning season. First, they cremated them on the battlefield. Then they placed the ashes in 10 separate coffins, one for each of the 10 tribes. Yet although the dead are all around us, then as now, many people in our society rarely see a corpse other than in the sanitized form in which it is dressed up in the so-called funeral home. By contrast, all Mediterranean societies lived in a degree of proximity and one might say kinship to death that is unimaginable to most people living in the West today. Life, for the majority, was nasty, brutish, and short, to quote the English philosopher Thomas Hobbes. And it was also a strictly family affair. For the Greeks and the Romans, death did not take place discreetly behind the closed walls of an institution. On the contrary, it was handled literally by the relatives of the deceased, by women particularly. The role of professionals was mainly confined to the transportation of the corpse to the grave. And this meant that virtually everyone would have observed death close up and personal from childhood onwards, in their own homes, in the street, and in the houses of friends and relatives, not to mention on the battlefield. So even small children had the opportunity to observe death at close quarters. Death was indeed ubiquitous. John Bedell estimates that around the time of Augustus, when Rome's population stood roughly at 750,000, perhaps more, some 30,000 residents died in the city each year. That means more than 80 deaths per day, a rate of 4% per annum. The countries in the European Union, by contrast, register about 1% per year, while the US death rate is slightly lower. This number would, however, have been considerably higher in times of epidemics. The imperial biographer Suetonius states that during the reign of Nero, an outbreak of plague claimed the lives of 30,000 in the autumn alone, and that's not counting all the deaths from other causes that year. Infant mortality was extremely high, perhaps as high as 25%. A particularly moving piece of evidence for infant mortality came to light in 1937 in a well that was excavated in the Agora at Athens. The well, since known as the Baby Well, has been dated by associated pottery finds to 165 to 150 BC. It contained the remains of 449 fetuses or neonates, and 40% of these reveal evidence of pathological abnormalities, cranial infections, cleft palate, stunted limbs, and hydrocephalus. We have no idea under what compulsion these fetuses and neonates were consigned to this communal spot, not buried, you'll note, but just thrown into the well, whether to avoid pollution or out of some vague sentimental desire to deposit them with others who had suffered a similar fate. Interestingly, the material dates to the time when the Romans were cracking down on Greece in their iron fist policy, though this is no doubt just a coincidence. Different cultures deal with death in their own idiosyncratic ways. No one put this better than Herodotus, the so-called father of history, who might also be described as the father of ethnography. Herodotus reports that the Persian king Darius once asked some Greeks who happened to be at his court what it would take for them to eat the corpses of their fathers. "Not for anything in the world," they replied, utterly horrified. He then turned to the Isidones, representatives of a tribe from India, whose practice was to eat their parents' dead bodies, and asked them what it would take for them to burn them. The Isidones were equally horrified, which, as Herodotus concludes, merely proves, in the words of the lyric poet Pindar, that custom is lord of all. So, let's now turn to the subject of Herodotus's anecdote, namely the disposal of the dead, where, as we'll see, there was considerable similarity between the Greeks and the Romans. Both practiced inhumation, that is to say, interment of the body, and cremation concurrently, though with differing degrees of frequency. Overall, cremation was practiced more by the wealthy, primarily because it was more costly than inhumation, given the scarcity of timber in the ancient world. As an aside, in classical antiquity, forested areas were increasingly reduced in size over time throughout the entire Mediterranean region, owing to the steady growth in the human population. And added to which, because of the paucity of rainfall in the region overall, once they'd been cut down, they had difficulty in growing back. Anyway, there's certainly no evidence to indicate that inhumation and cremation ever reflected contrasting views of the afterlife, though we can't altogether rule out that possibility. Lucian, who lived in the 2nd century AD, described cremation as a Greek custom, meaning perhaps that it was the Greeks who introduced it to the Romans. But there's not the slightest evidence to support his statement. He may well have based his claim on literary descriptions of cremation, such as we find in Homer. For reasons that are obscure, when the Greek-speaking East fell under Roman domination in the 2nd century BC, inhumation became the norm throughout that whole region, whereas in the Latin-speaking West, cremation prevailed. As we would expect, given the inherent bias of our evidence, it's the burial practices of the well-to-do that we know most about, partly because the well-to-do used funerals to demonstrate pride in their lineage. At aristocratic Roman funerals, for instance, the mourners wore masks of the ancestors of the deceased. Moving to the opposite end of the scale, we know next to nothing about how the corpses of slaves and of the destitute were handled, though the likelihood is that they were treated with a degree of casualness that would outrage our modern sensibility. Some slaves were buried with the family, but the overwhelming majority probably ended up in unmarked communal graves. Both among the Romans and among the Greeks, the proper disposal of one's dead relatives was the highest obligation of any family member. In Greek society, undertakers were only hired in exceptional circumstances, as when, for some reason, the immediate family was unable to perform the task, whereas their use was customary among the Roman upper classes. But as I noted earlier, they were primarily engaged to transport the body. Apart from the victims of war, both soldiers and civilians, the vast majority of people, as I said, died at home in the bosom of their family. For the majority, too, the onset of death would have come relatively swiftly and without any medical intervention. It was certainly not the duty of the medical profession to preserve and extend life at all costs. And once death was seen as inevitable, physicians would have had little role to play for the simple reason that they had virtually nothing to offer. Nor did religion have any role to play either. The pagan deities, unlike the Christian God, avoided the dying and offered them no consolation. And for this reason, the god of the underworld, Pluto, or Hades, to give him his other common name, did not receive cult. And in Euripides' play Hippolytus, when Artemis's favorite is dying, the goddess makes a hasty exit because, as she says, it is not permitted by divine law for a deity either to look at the dead or to sully their eyes with the expirations of the dying. Though elaborate rituals govern the disposal of the dead, neither society, to our best knowledge, conducted anything comparable to a formal burial service. In fact, very little is known about what went on at the graveside, and it may be that the relatives of the deceased simply improvised. Eulogies, however, were delivered in honor of the dead. I've already alluded to the funeral speech that was delivered over the war dead in Athens, and similarly in Rome, aristocrats would be honored with an oration delivered in the forum. No priest officiated at any funeral either in Greece or Rome. In fact, priests were debarred either from entering the house of the deceased or from attending a burial for fear that they would become polluted, a topic I'll talk about later. In terms of scale, nothing in antiquity equaled the funeral of Julius Caesar in 44 BC. Such was the overwhelming sense of loss among the populace of Rome that when Mark Antony read his will, Caesar bequeathed his magnificent gardens to the Roman people, plus a considerable sum of money to every citizen. They interrupted the proceedings, seized the body, built a fire, and cremated it there and then in the forum. Indeed, it was this event which sounded the death knell to the aspirations of Caesar's assassins, since it indicated how unpopular the murder had been. We hear of no funeral comparable in scale in the Greek world, though it's worth noting that there too politics played an equally important role in the handling of death. Alexander's former general Ptolemy, later Ptolemy I of Egypt, actually kidnapped the corpse of Alexander while it was en route to Macedon from Babylon, and then proceeded to promote himself as the guardian of his mortal remains so as to claim seniority over the other successors to his empire. In both societies, a dead body was regarded as polluting, and steps were taken to prevent its polluting influence from spreading into the community at large. From around the 8th century BC, burial within a settlement became rare in the Greek world, and the earliest Roman law code, the Law of the Twelve Tables, dated 450 BC, contains the provision, "The dead shall not be buried or burnt inside the city." The reason for the ban undoubtedly had something to do with the increase in population, which meant that space in the inhabited area was at a premium. But it probably also had something to do with a rather primitive sense of hygiene, as reflected in laws relating to pollution, which date from around this period. In Greek society, those who came into contact with the dead were debarred from full participation in the community until they had undergone purification. Among the Romans, by contrast, fear of individuals incurring pollution seems to have been somewhat weaker, or at any rate, we hear much less about it. There were no cemeteries as such in classical antiquity. Instead, major thoroughfares were particularly favored by the urban well-to-do, who built grandiose and imposing tombs which advertised their wealth and power. This was equally true of Athens as it was of Rome, and indeed of all major cities in the Greco-Roman world, and it remained true throughout pagan antiquity, despite periodic efforts to curb the expenses that was lavished on such structures. In Athens, the most prestigious road to be buried along was the so-called Street of Tombs in the Kerameikos, or Potter's Quarter. Each of the family plots is like a miniature fortress, and you have to strain your neck to see the funerary monuments placed inside them. In Rome, the equivalent was the Appian Way. One of the most impressive of the tombs along the Appian Way is the tomb of the Scipios, the family, you'll recall, who were among the most ardent Philhellenes in the late 3rd and 1st half of the 2nd century BC. And the tomb contains the remains of 6 generations. The best-known monument is the tomb of Caecilia Metella, which is in the form of a cylindrical drum over 30 feet high that rests on a square base. A much less expensive place of interment that was popular among the Romans, especially in the early imperial period, was the columbarium, literal meaning dovecot, which consisted of niches arranged in rows for the placing of cinerary urns. The largest columbaria could accommodate literally thousands of urns, all of which were identified by name tags. But what about the poor and the homeless? Many would have died without anyone to care for their remains. In fact, it's estimated that there were about 1,500 unclaimed bodies in Rome annually. These would probably have been tossed into the Tiber, or more commonly into open pits beyond the city walls. The latest datable burial in Rome that took place outside the city is put at AD 567, exactly the same year, incidentally, as the first datable burial inside the city. And that date also marks the beginning of the Christian practice of burial within consecrated ground. Next, let's talk about beliefs regarding the afterlife. As was universal in antiquity, as indeed is universal today, even in largely secular societies like Britain, where the current percentage of the population that attends church is just above 6% of the population overall, the thought of an unburied body filled most people with a deep sense of unease as well as of dread. This unease and dread translated themselves into the belief that the unburied dead were denied access to Hades and thus compelled to wander along the shore of the River Styx, which surrounded Hades. And though this rule was not invariably upheld in war, it was customary after battle to allow the defeated to return to the battlefield to recover their dead and dispose of them accordingly. One area where we can undoubtedly detect Greek influence on Roman religion is in the sphere of eschatology. That's to say, beliefs about the fate of the dead in the afterlife, including the belief in the immortality of the psuche, or soul. The word comes from the Greek eschatos, meaning what is final. There are virtually no surviving illustrations of Hades in any medium, although we do have images of Charon, the ferryman of the dead, taking his charge across the River Styx. What we mainly have to go on are literary descriptions, and it's questionable to say the least as to how representative they are of the population at large in terms of belief. The earliest description is in Homer's Odyssey, Book 11, which paints a very gloomy picture of the dead as being somewhat pathetic, inhabiting draughty halls, deprived of their wits, flitting uselessly about, uttering bat-like noises. The Iliad, too, has something to tell us about eschatology. When Zeus's son Sarpedon dies on the battlefield, he sends down sleep and death to bear Sarpedon away, accompanied by Hermes, who conducts the dead to Hades. The scene is illustrated on a mixing bowl by Euphronios, one of the masters of Attic red figure, so called because the figure appears in red against a black background. The vase, which is dated around 510 BC, was discovered in Etruria, which suggests that the Etruscans at this date could have identified the figures and perhaps have understood the allusion to Homer. Aristophanes' Frogs, written in 405 BC, maps out the topography with references to Cerberus, the many-headed dog that guards Hades, and Charon, the ferryman of the dead, but they are set in a comic context. Plato, in his dialogue, has a great deal to say about the afterlife. A leading text is the Phaedo, which purports to record the conversation which Socrates had on the night before his execution, in which he sought to prove that the soul is immortal. It was this dialogue, incidentally, which Cato the Younger is said to have read the night before he committed suicide in 46 BC, in preference to falling into the hands of Julius Caesar, which is proof of the extraordinary power of that work upon the Roman imagination. Plato also held to the view that the way one conducted oneself in one's previous existence conditioned what one came back as in one's next existence. though it's unlikely that this view gained wide acceptance. I now pass to our earliest Roman literary source for views about the afterlife, namely Plautus's comic play Mostellaria, The Haunted House, as it's inaccurately translated, written sometime around 200 BC, which alludes to the belief that the spirits of the dead haunt the houses of the living. Plautus's play is probably adapted from a Greek play, phasma, meaning ghost. Mostellaria is actually a diminutive adjective from monstrum, meaning ghost. So it literally means of a little ghost. In other words, a play about a little ghost. Another important text is Cicero's Dream of Scipio, which was written in the middle of the 1st century BC. In it, men of former times inform the great Philhellene, Scipio Aemilianus, that the soul on earth is temporarily imprisoned in the body, and that after death, the elect will return to the celestial realm from which they originated and dwell among the blessed dead in the Milky Way. However, the most extended and most important description of the afterlife in extant Latin literature comes in Book 6 of Virgil's Aeneid, set in the underworld. It provides a compendium, under one roof, so to speak, of the many competing beliefs that were current in his day, most of which originated with the Greeks. And we discover clear echoes of Homer's description of Hades, of Plato's teaching on the transmigration of souls, and of Stoic teaching about the spirit of the universe, the anima mundi, which is giving an overall sense of direction to Roman history. Though the majority of Greeks and Romans seem to have believed in an undifferentiated Hades where a common destiny awaited all, the so-called mystery religions held out the promise of blessedness in the hereafter for those who had undergone initiation into their secret rites. The most famous of these were the Eleusinian mysteries, which were celebrated for well over 1,000 years and which numbered among their initiates emperors including Hadrian and Marcus Aurelius. I'll be talking more about the Eleusinian mysteries later in this course. They influenced early Christianity. Quite clearly, the two societies held a number of eschatological ideas in common, although we should note that belief in Hades has its origins in much earlier societies, including the Sumerians and the Egyptians, and probably reached the Romans through the Etruscans as intermediaries. All in all, however, I think it's fair to say that there was probably as much disagreement and confusion among the Greeks and the Romans about what happened after death as there is in any society. And not everyone believed in the afterlife. Two philosophical groups that didn't were the Epicureans and the Stoics. I'll be talking about both in a later lecture devoted to philosophy. In Book 3 of his great poem, De Rerum Natura, On the Nature of Things, which offers a fullest extant exposition of the tenets of Epicureanism, the Roman epic poet Lucretius makes it one of his central objectives to eradicate man's fear of death and of the afterlife. The only thing that can dispel this fear, he claims, is an understanding of how nature conducts herself, both outwardly and inwardly. And he then proceeds to lay out 29 so-called proofs that the soul is mortal, based on the notion that it is actually corporeal, that's to say, made of very fine material, atoms, but material nonetheless, which is dispersed at the point of death. And he does this all in hexameter verse. Nothing, he concludes, survives after death, or at least nothing that is intrinsic to the human personality. Lucretius's philosophizing apart, what his poem does incontrovertibly prove, however, is that many of his highly educated readers were indeed fearful of punishment that was administered in Hades after death. By contrast, the Stoics maintained that the soul at death returns to the collective life force which governs the universe and which lacks individuation, and they too greatly influenced the Romans. Further evidence that not all Greeks and Romans believed in the afterlife comes from epitaphs. The common epitaph found on Roman graves reads, Non fui, fui, non sum, non curo. I didn't exist, then I existed, I don't exist now, and I don't give a damn. Eschatology apart, both societies, took active steps to foster links between the living and the dead. In Athens, for instance, relatives of the deceased were expected to pay regular visits to the place of interment, bringing offerings of food and drink to the deceased, which they placed on the tomb, rather as the peoples of Mexico and elsewhere remember the spirits of their beloved on the Day of the Dead, or El Día de los Muertos. In this way, a physical bond continued to exist between the two, since the dead were believed to be physically dependent for their welfare in Hades upon the living. We've already seen how important their ancestors were to the Romans, with noble families tracing their stock back to the Trojans. Collectively, the Roman dead were known as the Dimanes, that is to say, the gods who are the departed, or as the Maiores, the greater ones, and as such they received cult in the home, along with other minor deities. The Dimanes exercised an important influence over the welfare of their descendants, not least by providing stirring examples of courage, self-sacrifice and the like for their descendants to emulate. There's one last topic that I'd like to touch on briefly, namely suicide. Fear of and hostility towards suicides is a common phenomenon shared by many societies, including the Greeks. In England, the practice of driving a stake through the body of a suicide and then burying it at the crossroads was only finally abandoned in 1823. According to Plato, Socrates, on his last night, declared that the gods, who are our guardians, have put us in a kind of prison from which we must not try to escape. For Aristotle, too, suicide was seen as an act of social irresponsibility. Plutarch reports that in Greece, in his day, the turn of the 2nd century AD, the bodies of those who had hanged themselves were thrown into the barathron, the pit into which common murderers were hurled. The Romans looked more favourably upon suicide when it was resorted to as an honourable way out of an intolerable situation. An example is Lucretia, who took her own life after revealing that she'd been raped by the son of Tarquinius Superbus, the last king of Rome. And the Stoics, too, judged it to be acceptable under certain conditions. Their founder, Zeno, is reported to have committed suicide after he stumbled and dislocated a toe. In the 1st century AD, in line with Stoic precepts, suicide among the Roman elite became elevated into a test of manly excellence by the Emperor Nero, who, instead of executing his political opponents outright, graciously permitted them to take their own lives. One of his most famous victims was Petronius, possibly the author of the Satyricon, a Roman novel, who gathered his friends around him and discoursed wittily for many hours, opening and shutting his veins to postpone his end before he finally expired in mid-banquet. I'd like to note one very important difference between the pagans and their Christian counterparts, both ancient and modern, in respect to death. The pagans, as they approach death, do not seem to have been overburdened by any sense of guilty foreboding. Death was largely a transition from one world to another. The Greeks commonly talked of going from here to there. And because there was no notion of sin for the majority, there was equally no notion of retribution. All that changed, of course, with the advent of Christianity, when death took on a deep spiritual significance which had previously been virtually unknown in the ancient world, and when the fear of eternal damnation became widespread. There was some evidence for fear of death, as we've seen, but it wasn't as emphatically at the centre as it was under Christianity. To conclude, with the exception of funerals conducted on behalf of the war dead and other servants of the state, such as politicians, the disposal of the dead was a private affair, both for the Greeks and for the Romans, handled almost exclusively by the family. In the next lecture, we're going to talk about religion in the public sphere, and in so doing, we will see how Roman religion continued to show the influence of Greek religion well into the Christian era.